May it please the Court. Your Honors, there's two issues in this case. One is a factual basis issue, and the second is failure to advise of a lesser offense. The charge here is assault in the first degree, and I'd like to start with the second issue first. So what I'm saying is that the defense attorney was ineffective for failing to advise his client that, hey, you can mitigate assault first by arguing that there was sudden passion arising out of adequate cause that mitigates the offense to assault second, and you could defend on that theory. So what happens in this case is my client and some of his friends are hanging out at Jack in the Box, and a group of other people also arrive at Jack in the Box, and one of them decides that he's going to mess with and put himself on a female friend of, actually the cousin of my client. So I allege that there was sexual harassment going on, and that what happened when that started, meaning the victim's friend started engaging in sexually harassing my client's female cousin. At that point, my client's friend gets out of the car and says, hey, what are you doing? And there's some pushing and shoving going on there. And then the harasser's friend then gets out and starts swinging on my client's friend. At that point, my client reacts by punching him, and then the rest of the group jumps in, and there's an assault that proceeds from there. So the charge from the state is assault first. The question is sudden passion a viable defense? And if so, shouldn't I get a hearing that the defense attorney was ineffective for failing to advise him of it? There's nothing in the record that refutes my claim.
What is the significance of the fact that the motion court found on the record that this would not be a viable defense?
Well, Your Honor, so I don't think that's up for the court to decide. It's a jury issue. And just like in Jackson and Pierce, when there's issues of lessers, it's a jury issue. It's not for the judge to decide. It should be submitted.
The facts are certainly for the jury, I understand. But assuming everything you said is believed, is that legally adequate cause that somebody was harassing your cousin's friend so you hit their friend?
Well,
how is that adequate cause legally, assuming?
You hit their friend?
Uh-huh.
Okay. Well, what I alleged in my amended motion was it wasn't just the sexual harassment. So after the victim's friend is sexually harassing my client's cousin, at that point, the harasser's friend, who's the victim, gets out of his car and attempts to physically assault my client's friend, who's simply trying to help out someone who's being sexually harassed. So it inflames him even more. So on the one hand, it inflames him that his cousin is being sexually harassed. And in addition to that, when his friend tries to help her out, he gets assaulted, physically assaulted. That's very upsetting. That can be very upsetting.
You're saying it was defense of others, in effect.
That could be another possible defense. Yes, Your Honor. However, in this case, they might say, well, it was excessive force or things of that nature. It could not be self-defense, but that's a possible defense as well.
Defense of others.
But it could also be a sudden passion arising out of adequate cause. It's a jury question. State versus Turner says it does not have to be directed at him. And the statute itself on sudden passion, there's nothing about it that says it has to be directed at the person. It's anything that inflames, that provokes him. And it's a jury question. Is that something that could provoke someone, a person of ordinary temperament, to that kind of conduct? Then, if so, the jury has a right to say, yes, you get assault in the second degree. And there's nothing in what was said at the factual basis that would refute that. It's all consistent. So the prosecutor is not being forthcoming is what I'm trying to say. Because what I've alleged in my amended motion is that the police reports corroborate what I've alleged in my amended motion, and I've put forth what they said, and that the defense attorney was aware of what those police reports said, that there were witnesses who said, yeah, he was putting himself on her and then that other friend came out of the car and tried to assault the guy who tried to intervene. So the police reports all corroborate that. Now, what the state says is minimizing. Oh, at some point, Mr. Luther Jones started talking to Jasmine Jeffries, and an argument ensued. Doesn't tell you how the argument ensued or why that argument came about. Well, I'm telling you why that argument came about, because there was some sexual harassment going on. Putting himself on her, messing with her, which is in the reports and in my amended motion. Then it says Johnny Lane got out of his vehicle, that's the my client's cousin, started arguing with Luther Jones, who was the friend who was sexually harassing, and they started pushing each other. Then the victim, Ali Aziz, went up to the situation. What do you mean, went up to the situation? What does that mean? Well, how did he go up to the situation? Did he peacefully go up to the situation, or did he go up to the situation by swinging on my client's friend, who was simply trying to intervene on someone who was getting sexually harassed? And that's what I've alleged in my amended motion. In fact, in the police reports, the witness said that's what happened. He got out of the car and swung at the person who tried to intervene on the lady being sexually harassed. So it's all completely consistent. It's not refuted by the record. State versus Turner says, is a Supreme Court case that says it does not have to be directed at the person, especially if it's a family member. And it says it's a jury question. And there's nothing in the definition of sudden passion or adequate cause that it says it has to be directed at the person. It's anything that could provoke a person of reasonable temperament to that kind of conduct. So even if, let's suppose a man's wife is having sex with another person, that's a classic law school example of sudden passion arising out of adequate cause, but that's not directed at the guy. They're just doing something completely different on their own. That's not directed at anybody. That's not a requirement. State versus Turner says, especially when there's family members involved, it doesn't have to be. And I believe at the sentencing hearing, the defense attorney actually says, Judge, as the sentencing judge, this occurred when Rashawn Booker was 17 years old. It occurred at a Jack in the Box here in downtown St. Louis late one night after two strangers approached his cousin, Jasmine Jeffries. It's stated in the SAR report, Judge, that there was some arguing and touching between Jeffries and these strangers. So it's consistent. The allegations I've put forth are consistent with the evidence contained in the record, and I believe for all those reasons I should get a hearing. Does the court have any questions about that particular issue? Okay, then there's a bigger issue here, and that issue is whether there was a factual basis for the charge of assault in the first degree to begin with. And there's a couple of things I'd like to point out here. First of all, there's no agreement between anybody here to commit a crime. So those cases they're talking about where two people agree to commit a crime and then someone commits something that's foreseeable in the furtherance of the crime, that's not the situation here. This is a spontaneous reaction to a stimulus of someone being sexually harassing and physically assaulted. And people are just reacting independently. There's no agreement on anyone's part to commit any sort of crime. So this is something that distinguishes this case from those other types of cases, and it's something, a critical fact that should not be ignored. So in my amended motion, I've alleged that the plea was not knowingly, voluntarily, and intelligently entered. That was in paragraph A. I've alleged that there was no factual basis for the plea. And I've alleged that...
You're alleging the language was inadequate to inform him that he had to personally have the intent as opposed to that his co-perpetrator.
So during the plea colloquy, the defense attorney gets up there and points out some things. The court says after the plea colloquy is laid, after the prosecutor recites facts, the court says, Mr. Khalil, off the record, you said that you had some question about the chronology of events, especially regarding the timing or the chronology concerning your client's participation in the episode vis-a-vis Mr. Aziz being kicked in the head. Is that correct? That's correct. He says, our standpoint regarding the series of events would be that the stomping occurred subsequent to Mr. Booker's contact with the victim. Mr. Booker is my client. Subsequent. Stomping occurs subsequent to his contact. So So that erases principal liability. He goes on to say, and the prosecutor even concedes, and I believe that is correct, Your Honor. I was simply reading the summary of the events that Mr. Booker did. Our evidence would show Mr. Booker hit Mr. Aziz while he was on the ground. It may have been before he was kicked in the head by Jasmine Jeffries. They go on to say, the defense attorney goes on to say that, or the court actually says at page 21 of the transcript, and it was subsequent to that second hitting that Mr. Aziz was kicked at least twice in the head and suffered head injuries. The defense attorney says that's true. As to the exact specific amount of time, I think that is a different question as well. There was a series of contact made. He goes on to say that at some point Mr. Booker fled the scene. And
opposing counsel says, well, your client said, I understand what I'm pleading guilty to, and I plead guilty, and that's enough, and you don't have to recite all the facts.
Right, but he has to plead guilty with an awareness of the elements of the offense. So under accomplice liability, there's, I don't know where it started, but some courts have had some differing ideas of what is accomplice liability. But if you go back to the statutes, you can see exactly what it is. 562.036 says, a person with a required culpable mental state is guilty of an offense. It says nothing more. 562.041 tells you what that mental state is. Now, also 562.036 says a person with a required culpable mental state can be found guilty if it's committed by himself or actions for which he can be held liable. 562.041 goes on to tell you when he can be held liable. And that's when he acts to promote an offense. He can be held liable for an offense. But then the question is, to what degree of offense is he liable for? Is he liable to the same degree as the principal, or is he liable to some other degree? And 562.051 is a statute which has absolutely been ignored for about 25, 30 years. And it says that you can vary the degree of culpability, and it's the depending on the mental state of the individual person. So you cannot.
You're saying there's two inconsistent lines of cases. This court's cases numerous times have recognized this requirement.
Absolutely.
But the various court of appeals cases recently have ignored that.
Yes, Your Honor. Absolutely. And what they're doing is failing to realize that 562.041 only says when someone can be held liable for the conduct of another. It says nothing about when someone can be found guilty. On the other hand, 562.036 says when someone can be found guilty. 562.051 says when someone can be found guilty. And there's a comment in 562.051 that actually says there was a question at common law. Clearly, if the purpose of the person is different, that should be taken into account. State versus White actually said that.
Counsel, if you'll try to sum up your argument, you're about a minute over already.
Okay. Oh, I'm sorry. I will reserve my time then, Your Honor.
Thank you.
May it please the Court? I'll begin with the first point, the sufficient factual basis. Now, in State v. Taylor, this Court stated that when an accused admits in open court facts which constitute the offense for which he is charged, he cannot thereafter withdraw his plea on the assertion that he did not understand the nature of the charge to which he pleaded guilty. Now, because of that standard,
Isn't there a difference? Your brief seems to be focused, and maybe the case law have mingled the two. Your brief seems to be focused on whether he knowingly pled guilty. And you're saying because they read the charges to him, he knew what the elements of the offense is. But isn't the requirement for a factual basis a different requirement? And that's because the courts believe we shouldn't allow someone to be found guilty who isn't actually guilty. And so we know that people may come before the court and say they're going to plead guilty, but we're not going to allow them to plead guilty unless there are, in fact, facts that can be shown that support that. And what if that's true, then that's a totally different issue.
Well, As a general statement, that might be true. What it boils down to, though, and what the courts have repeatedly stated is that when we are taking those considerations into account, the key question is, did the defendant understand the nature of the charge against him?
And again, that's what I was asking you, is have the courts confused those two concepts and focused on did they intend to plead guilty, not whether there were facts that were recited to the trial court so the trial court could understand that there was in fact a factual basis that justified the court accepting that guilty plea.
My reading of the case law is that they have tried to get away from the technical, were all the elements explained to the defendant understand all of the elements, including something like this, the intent requirement. They've gotten away from that.
The defendant doesn't have to understand what he's pleading to, you're saying? We've gotten away from that?
They've gotten away from a technical exercise in reciting every element of the offense on the record.
But I'm not talking, we said if you can infer, if he admits the fact, it's okay that you didn't recite them to him if in his answer he admits them. But here he's saying, I don't think there's cases saying a mere recital of the elements is enough. You have to plead to the facts that support the offense. And here he's saying the questions he was asked and what was recited do not show him either admitting to the fact that he had the intent to cause grievous bodily harm, nor was that stated by the prosecutor, nor is it set out any place to disabuse him of his belief that he could be liable if his companions had that intent.
And again, you're stating the question as, was there enough in the record to show that he intentionally and voluntarily entered a plea? And that's very different from, was there a factual basis in the court to support the court accepting that plea?
Well, so I question whether, in the specific facts of this case, whether we need to get to this question at all. Feel free, of course, to redirect me to your question, but I'm going to just point out that in the plea colloquy, the defendant admitted to these facts, that he, acting with four other people, struck the victim, and such conduct was a substantial step toward the commission of the crime of attempting to kill or cause serious physical injury to the victim, and it was done for the purpose of committing that assault. The defendant admitted to those facts.
But the defendant also made this whole point about the sequence of events and the chronology, as opposing counsel is pointing out, consistent with his claim that he didn't understand he had to have the intent. He thought he acted with them. They had the intent to do that. He's responsible for it. The jury or judge may well not believe what he has to say, but that is a key fact given 051, which says it's your intent, even as an accomplice, that matters for the degree of crime to which you're convicted.
Regardless of any subsequent fact that he alleged, he admitted that he had the intent to kill or cause serious
physical injury. So it depends on our reading of what he said. If we read it as you said, if we don't read it that way, then what's the effect? If I were to look at what you're doing, and I'll look at it and look at both your arguments, if I agree with you, I understand your point. If I disagree with you, and I don't think he admitted that he personally had that level of intent, then what is your response?
Well,
what is the proper remedy, or how do we go forward?
Well, as far as interpreting the accomplice statute, again, my point is that we don't have to get to any interpretation of accomplice liability, because under any interpretation, the defendant has admitted that he had that intent. But as pointed out by the Eastern District Johnson case, this court in White has said that the 051 statute does not create any added element of intent.
But it does say that he has to have a particular intent to be convicted of a particular degree. What meaning are you giving that statute?
So in certain circumstances, right, that statute, 051, could have significance. I think most notably in the first-degree murder cases, which...
But it's not a first-degree murder statute. I mean, you're saying mostly we should ignore it, what it says about degrees of offense depend on your level of intent? I'm not understanding the rationale of those cases that you're relying on. You're saying we don't have to pay attention to the language of the statute.
No, Your Honor, I don't think that that's necessarily true. I just think that the legislature put that there so that under certain circumstances we could find an accomplice perhaps less guilty or guilty to a different degree than co-defendants. But parallel to that concept, we have the case law by this court stating that that statute does not impose any additional intent requirement. And at the same time, we have the overwhelming body of case law in the lower appellate courts, and arguably this court as well, stating that, right, when you embark on a course of criminal conduct, you're responsible for your own actions as well as any crimes that you could reasonably anticipate would be committed. But again, the defendant's own admissions here would constitute a sufficient factual basis for liability even as a principal. And so just accomplice considerations just don't come into play at all given the defendant's admissions on the record. And so any factual allegations that he may have made in his amended motion would simply be refuted by the plea colloquy and subsequent admissions on the record. What I'd also like to point out is the pleading requirements for a post-conviction case. Now, as a threshold matter, the defendant did not allege the required prejudice after a guilty plea. After a guilty plea for post-conviction relief, you have to allege that but for the supposed error, you would not have pleaded guilty and would have insisted on going to trial. The defendant flatly failed to allege that in this case.
He did allege that at the end of it after he talks about the first and then talks about the second ground, and then he says, I would have not have pleaded guilty and would have gone to trial.
For the sudden passion count,
yes.
He alleges that but for the sudden passion error, he would not have pleaded guilty and gone to trial. But each count is its own. To get to an evidentiary hearing and ultimately relief on PCR, you have to allege that but for any particular error, that error caused prejudice, and the required prejudice for a PCR is you would not have pleaded guilty and would have gone to trial. He never alleged that but for this supposed insufficient factual basis, he would not have pleaded guilty and would have gone to trial.
But the reason he said it was an insufficient factual basis was because he didn't understand that his own personal intent mattered. He thought that of his associates was sufficient, and his own personal intent, we know from count two, was that he acted out of sudden passion. So how can you separate those?
They're separate claims. If the defendant intended for them to be related or consolidated, he could have done so, but he did not. His amended motion is two distinct claims, and in fact, a sufficient factual basis doesn't connect at all to the sudden passion defense. A sufficient factual basis is that I hit the guy. I didn't mean to cause serious physical injury. Apparently, the kicking is what causes serious physical injury. But as I'll sidestep, even to that, the factual allegations about that are suspect because the defendant admitted that he punched the victim, in fact, starting the assault, hard enough that the victim fell to the ground suddenly onto a hard parking lot surface, whereafter the defendant punched the victim again. And so by the facts of the events that the defendant admits to, it seems more likely, highly likely, that the serious physical injury was caused by the defendant himself. But back to the point, right? As a threshold matter, the defendant has failed to allege the required prejudice and is not entitled to an evidentiary hearing on that alone. But furthermore, the defendant also has to, even when there is not a sufficient factual basis stated explicitly on the record, a defendant must allege that he was deprived of the actual knowledge of the factual basis. And he did not do that here. Here, his argument rests on this technicality that he did not, quote, affirmatively express an understanding of the requisite intent, and that there was a, quote, possibility that he pleaded guilty without the purpose to cause serious physical injury. But this sort of technicality argument has been squarely rejected by the courts, that there is no particular ritual that has to be performed in a plea hearing. All the elements don't have to be read to the defendant, let alone the defendant affirmatively recite them. So fatally, the defendant failed, in addition to failing to allege the required prejudice, he failed to allege that he did not understand the nature of the charge or that he was deprived of actual knowledge of the factual basis. He failed to allege that he didn't understand the requisite intent. He failed to allege that he didn't have the requisite intent. He failed to allege that he did not act with the purpose to kill or cause serious physical injury. And so as a threshold matter, his factual pleadings, allegations in his amended motion were insufficient to receive an evidentiary hearing. I lastly will touch on the second point, the sudden passion defense. Now, in his reply brief, the defendant admits that the victim here did not participate in the alleged sexual harassment. The victim was in the car while this alleged harassment occurred, and the statute for sudden passion is very clear that the victim has to engage in the conduct so the provocation must be by the victim or someone acting with the victim.
Well, he's saying the provocation was the victim going to hit his friend who was coming to someone's rescue.
So, right, that's what he would have to allege now, because the alleged sexual harassment, it's very clear the defendant concedes that the victim had nothing to do with that. So any sexual harassment cannot be considered in a sudden passion argument. And so all we're left with is, right, the alleged swinging.
I'm going to interrupt you because you're about to run out of time. Do you agree that the case law appears to ignore the statute that provides an accessory should only be convicted of the offense that is equal to their intent?
I don't think so.
Are there cases in the last 30 years that when they were analyzing this issue, discuss and refer to the statute?
So 051 that I saw has gotten little, if any, discussion about accomplice liability for whatever reason. 041 is discussed, and that has been interpreted that, right, when you engage on embark on a course of criminal conduct, you're responsible for any crimes you could reasonably anticipate. The 051, the only case law that I ran across was that it doesn't add any additional element of intent over 041.
And what cases are those?
That the Johnson Eastern District case citing the State versus White case by this court.
But the statute specifically says it doesn't add a level of intent. It explains when two or more persons are criminally responsible for an offense which is divided into degrees, each person is guilty of such degree as is compatible with his own mental state, which makes sense. It's not adding something. It's describing the level of offense. I mean, you're ignoring the statute. You're saying it's okay because other courts have. I'd rather you explain why this supports your result than that we should continue to ignore its existence.
Sure. Again, I'm happy to answer your direct question, but under the facts of this case...
Well, why don't you do that first?
Sure. So... I mentioned the first-degree murder before, and I mean that is the only case law that I've seen where this statute comes into play.
But I understand that's only one. But logically, what is the distinction? This doesn't say in a first-degree murder case the level of your guilt depends upon your personal intent. Although, and it's not adding, and it wouldn't be adding an element to do so, because of course you do have to prove different levels of intent to convict people of different crimes, and that is true here. What this is making clear is that you're responsible for your own intent, and that's the element that has to be proved, not somebody else's intent. It's not adding an element, it's explaining what is meant by the intent or element that's already in the crime.
So one of the things that I think is problematic about the entire statutory scheme is that intent is so... I mean, it's usually inferred by the defendant's actions. It is rarely capable of proof by direct evidence. And so there surely are some cases where a defendant's culpable mental state will be different than a co-defendant's. And so in that instance, the defendant, I suppose, could make that argument to the court, to the jury, to the plea court, but here he admitted that he had the requisite mental state under any circumstance.
What is it in the facts of this case that would support an inference, or what circumstantial evidence supports an inference that Mr. Booker had an intent to kill or cause serious physical injury?
During the plea colloquy, the prosecutor went over, essentially reading from the charging document, that the defendant, acting with four other people, struck the victim, and such conduct was a substantial step toward the commission of the crime of attempting to kill or cause serious physical injury to the victim.
And my understanding is the facts are that he hit him, he fell down, he hit him again. At that time, the violence had not escalated to a point of causing serious injuries, and then he didn't do anything further. Do you disagree in that you think there are additional facts?
I don't necessarily think that there are additional facts, but I do disagree with the conclusion that the defendant did not cause a serious physical injury. When the defendant initiates the assault by punching the victim hard enough that the victim falls to the ground, such a sudden punch with such force, in all likelihood, would cause the defendant's head to hit the ground, and that's a hard concrete parking lot. And then the defendant punches the victim again while on the ground. It seems in the most likely scenario that is what caused a serious physical injury and not any subsequent assault to the victim.
Counselor, you're out of time.
Thank you.
Your Honors,
what did you allege as far as prejudice in regard to the claim that there was insufficient factual basis?
Your Honor, I pled that he did not knowingly, voluntarily, and intelligently plead guilty. That is the prejudice and the factual basis. Under Rule 24.02, the record has to show that he pled guilty knowingly, voluntarily, and intelligently. In all cases where the state fails to do that, there's a reversal. So the state cites to five cases. There are only five cases which supports the state's position that he has to show that he was somehow deprived. And I do believe that I showed that I alleged that I was deprived, or my client was deprived, because I alleged that he did not knowingly, voluntarily, and intelligently plead guilty, and that there was no factual basis. It's in paragraph 8A as well as, or in both. It's in paragraph 8, and I believe it's 8A and 9A. So don't just look in 9, but also in 8. And then, as far as those cases that say that he has to show that he was actually deprived of the knowledge, there's only five out there. There's Finley versus State, Scarborough versus State, Chipman versus State, Bott versus State, Gooch versus State. They all cite to Chipman versus State for that proposition. Chipman cites to nothing, and all they do is say that and then go on to find that the plea was knowingly entered, because there's other parts of the record that show that it was knowingly entered, like at sentencing or other parts of other proceedings show that it was knowingly entered. So at best, it's dictum. There's no case that has ever said that where that's not alleged that you lose because of that reason. So at best, it's dictum, and I've also alleged that he did not knowingly, voluntarily, intelligently plead.
You mean by definition, if it's not knowing, voluntary, and intelligent, it can't be accepted. It's
exactly. Under Rule 24.02, it says the court shall not accept such a factual basis. At that point, the plea has to be vacated. The remedy is not even to remand.
The general allegations where he admitted that he understood the nature of the offense, isn't there a reasonable inference that the court could accept from that that he understood what he was pleading guilty to?
Your Honor,
and
I believe
that it satisfies
the
knowing requirement?
Your Honor, in this case, there's a misunderstanding. The state has the same misunderstanding that the defense attorney had, and they are not aware of 562.051. They're not realizing that you can mitigate. And that's because there's all these appellate cases out there that say you can't mitigate. But so State versus Johnson is the case he's talking about. There's no difference between 562.051 and 562.041. But what that case does, it cites the State versus White, this court's case, for that proposition, but disregards the fact that in State versus White, the court held that it has to be the purpose to promote the offense charged and not some other offense. And then there's other cases that all say the same thing. All of this court's cases say it has to be the purpose to promote the offense charge. That's what 562.051 says. That's what the comment to 562.051 says. And 562.041 only says when you can hold someone when you can be liable for the conduct of another. It doesn't say when you can be found guilty or what you should be found guilty of.
Thank you, Counselor. You're out of time.